I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about the rights patients and their loved ones have when those patients are undergoing medical care. We're going to talk about what options people have when something goes wrong in the hospital or in the doctor's office, and how often things do go wrong there. And we're going to talk about what is the right thing to do in those situations. Joining me for the discussion will be Betty Tonsing, author of Stand in the Way, Patient Advocates Speak Out, and former State Representative David Orentlicker, who also is both a constitutional law professor and a medical doctor. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about patient rights and advocacy. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, my guests are Betty Tonsing, who is the author of Stand in the Way, Patient Advocates Speak Out. Betty, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
And we also have with us former State Representative David Orentlicker, who is the Samuel R. Rosen Professor of Law, co-director of the William S. and Christine S. Hall Center for Law and Health at Indiana University, and also a medical doctor. This is one of several return visits for you, David. Good to have you here.
It's good to be back. Thanks.
And I should point out, actually, David is such a longtime veteran of this program. He actually was one of the guests on the pilot we did for the show years ago. Well, Betty, I'm going to start with you. Tell me a little bit about the genesis of your book. Obviously, there is a personal story behind it. And let's start at that point, because I think people need to know the human stakes before we talk about the larger issue.
When you have someone you know, it could be a family member, a friend, going into the hospital, it's not uncommon that somebody goes in with them to sort of be there. I don't think that people anticipate a crisis, but they're just there. They understand the person is going to be going through a procedure. There'll be some medication involved, and they just want to be a support beyond just bringing them home. And of course, I think gone are the days that people have to run out and get a Burger King because the hospital food's really good. So people may wonder, you know, what is my role here? And that's been the role. I obviously served as a wife for my husband. He had had a few other operations, and this was no different. He went in for a routine knee replacement in May of 2011. And went into rehab after that. A knee replacement's pretty tricky, and I was working full-time. We lived in a two-story townhouse, and it made sense. And we anticipated he'd be there for a couple of weeks. While he was in rehab, he picked up a blood clot, went back to the hospital. He was afraid he had perhaps picked up also his roommate's pneumonia. He had been sent to the hospital a few days earlier with that. So I think he was already compromised when he went in. Removing the clot, I guess, was fine. On Saturday, they left him there overnight. When I went back on Sunday, my husband was in a real state of crisis. He was shaking uncontrollably. It made no sense. I had to feed him. I couldn't keep his hands out of his fingers out of his food. And I thought, what on earth is going on? What had happened, John, is he had picked up a hospital infection. And I thought, well, they'll take care of this in a few days with some powerful antibiotics. And it took 30 days leaving the hospital to go to a specialty hospital. And all of this opened up a whole new avenue for me. I've got a pretty good educational background. I'm pretty familiar with having other visits with my husband. But this took me as a patient advocate to a level I did not anticipate, and to a role that I described as being thrown on the deep end of a pool with no previous swimming lessons. And that's a patient advocate in crisis. There's just no previous experience for it. And his infection was so virulent, I wondered what century we were in. I thought this was the sort of thing we had taken care of in the 19th century. I was in so long that you begin to, and I began to notice things that when you're in the hospital for as long as he was, you begin to observe things that you wouldn't normally observe when you're there for just a few days. Charts not being read, errors occurring, having to step in at a time, and perhaps they've walked into the wrong room, not just for me, but with other people. I started talking with other people who had been there for quite some time. And I said, well, why are you here? I was getting concerned about what I was observing, which were clearly mishaps, and stories that concerned me even greater than my own. And I called a friend of mine. After 2 weeks, I was being ignored, and I knew the situation was becoming more serious. And I was basically being shut out. And, of course, I was trying to become more demanding with information because I was getting scared. And my husband was really becoming in more and more of a hopeless situation. And I sought the help of a very close friend of mine who is a nurse professional for over 40 years with extensive experience, and she was able to help fill in the blanks even though she wasn't providing as direct care. And she encouraged me because of I'm a history professor and because of my background in research to really delve more into this. And that's when I had the idea of beginning to keep a journal. I'm not big on journal. I'm big on writing, but not necessarily journals. But as a friend of mine said, Betty, write when things are raw and immediate. And John, that was the genesis for writing the book. But it couldn't just be my journal. I knew this was happening to other people. I felt alone, but I thought I can't possibly be alone. So I did. I had a survey, which was surveyed by social scientists, not historians. Mm-hmm. Historians are always looking for gossip, where social scientists are looking for unbiased questions. And this survey was responded to by hundreds of other people across the country as patient advocates who also wanted their experience heard. And that was amazing. And then there were more people who wanted to be interviewed. That told me that this was a very, very situation. I was learning about hospital infections and medical errors in the process of writing the book. That's when I learned that death by medical error and hospital infections are the third leading cause of death in the United States.
And roughly how many people are affected?
That's upwards of about 440,000 people now, which is up. There was a study that was just done by Dr. John James in his own research with the death of his own son in an emergency room. This was covered in the Journal of Patient Safety last September. The first study that was done that was published by the Institute, U.S. Institute of Medicine in 1999, to Air is Human, which, you know, errors do occur, and they are human. That's a wonderful title. But at that time, there were about 100,000 people who were dying from medical error and another 100,000 from hospital infections. But what he found was that that had significantly increased over the last decade to be upwards of 440,000. Sully Sullenberger, the hero of the Hudson, is somebody who's recently gotten on board with patient safety along with his other advocacy issues. And he uses an analogy that I describe in my book using jumbo jets. It's the equivalency, he said, of two jumbo jets holding approximately 500 people, crashing every day, killing everybody on board. And that, he said, would shut down his industry.
David, what are, in a circumstance such as that, such as the one Betty and her husband went through, what are the options confronting people? What first? Your husband's name was George, right?
George Carter.
What would George's rights and options be in that case, and what would Betty's be as a family member?
During the process or now after all the
Why don't we start with the process where there's something that's gone wrong at that moment while the situation's still recoverable or presumably still recoverable?
Yeah, no, one of the sad things is, as Betty says, these are all too common, that the numbers, hundreds of thousands of people, errors, medical errors, and it's a serious problem that we're not doing enough about. And so there are two things. How, you know, what can you do to prevent it? And then once it's happened, what are your rights afterwards? And, and once an error has occurred, we do have, under law, you can sue, and we have tort liability. You can, and when somebody acts negligently, they are held accountable and they can pay. But, you know, recovering dollars doesn't cure the problem. the goal of tort liability is to make you whole, to compensate for your injury. But if you die, money doesn't really bring you back to
there's
life.
There's no real way to make that
The problem. And so that's why so much of it is focused on prevention, as Betty talks about in her book. You know, we trust doctors, and for good reason. We have to trust doctors. But doctors make mistakes, as the Institute of Medicine report said, to err is human. And that's why you have to trust your doctor, but you also have to recognize that mistakes can be made and that you have to keep an eye on things. And if something seems not to be right, you have to speak up. And it's very hard in the medical setting because of the power differential. We're not used to challenging doctors because they have such great expertise, and lay people don't have that kind of information. But anytime something seems amiss, you know, it's so important to speak up. And it's better for both sides. They need to understand if something seems off, and so I think that's one of the most important messages is and not to hesitate. Better to speak up too much than too little.
We are talking about patient rights and advocacy here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can tumble upon us on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Gary did and reach out to us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Gary's question is, please explain the process when a patient has experienced of a loss of or is not conscious, not in effect able to exercise his or her own rights. In that case, you know, who is the person who is considered next most important, or who gets the decision-making authority? David, I'm going to start with you.
Yeah, you turn to the closest family member. If there's a legal guardian, then the legal guardian has priority, but absent that kind of a situation, and the usual presumption, if you're married, that your spouse, that's after all the family member you picked, and then you would look to parents and siblings and adult children. So there's usually a hierarchy that, based on whom we normally view as the most reliable representative. That said, there are cases when the people might be estranged from their spouse. They might have a better relationship with a cousin than with a sibling. And so the goal is to always turn to the family member or even a close friend who is going to best represent the patient's interests and wishes. And we have presumptions in favor of spouses, and then again, parents and children and siblings. But if you're a physician and you can, if it's clear to you, I remember when I consulted on a case, it was clear that the brother was a better representative of the patient than the spouse. And so our obligation was to turn to the brother, who we were confident would better represent the patient's interests.
Betty. Yeah.
I need to add, though, I advise everyone, because I have an opportunity, when I talk about my experience, John, inevitably somebody says, oh my gosh, they have their own story. And I tell people, you must have the medical power of attorney. If you have just the power of attorney, that's not going to give you access to the medical chart. In the situation that Gary just described, particularly if the person's unconscious and they can't speak for themselves, unless you have the medical power of attorney, just being a spouse alone may not give you the right within a hospital or medical emergency environment to really speak as fully, and it won't give you access to the medical chart. And I also want to say
that is an area I want to explore,
it's
too,
very
is
important.
The whole, well, and that whole area of who gets to drive what is, in essence, medical care, where the line should be drawn. But we're going to run out of time here before we head to the break. Anyhow, I apologize. I interrupted
you, Betty.
That's okay.
No, but it's important. That I made the most important point. Medical power of attorney is everything.
And what is medical power of attorney, David?
Betty's exactly right. You can anticipate these problems by filling out, it's a very simple form where you designate the person you want to speak for you. It could be your spouse, it could be a sibling, it could be a friend, it could be anybody that you choose, an adult, that you say, if I'm not able to make decisions for me, I want this person. And whenever you're unable to speak, whether it's temporary or permanent, that person has clear legal authority. And it really cuts through a lot of the problems that can occur when people haven't given their wishes, then who do we turn to? There might be disagreements among family members. But once you've appointed somebody and given them power of attorney, that settles the problem.
And are you limited to one person? I mean, if you're in a situation where you have grown children, for example.
Yeah.
You can do whatever you want. You
That's
can
right.
say, I want them to have equal decision-making authority. You can say, I give priority to one. And that's a good question. Is it better if you have shared authority? That can raise problems. It is a good idea to, whatever you decide on who's going to have primary authority, to designate a backup person.
Yep.
Because your primary person may not be available. They may die before, in the meantime. So it's always good to set up, like you do with your will, your property. Here's my primary beneficiary. Here's my secondary.
We are talking about patient rights and advocacy here on No Limits. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about patient rights and advocacy. My guests are Betty Tonsing, who is the author of Stand in the Way, Patient Advocates Speak Out, and David Orentlicker, former state representative, lawyer, constitutional law professor, and medical doctor. We were talking just before the break about the importance of getting medical power of attorney. And Betty, you wanted to make a point before we ran out of time that this is not a difficult thing to do.
No, I think when people hear that, it's kind of like a will. Oh, my gosh, do I have to get an attorney? Do I have to pay a lot of money? No, you just go online, type in your state, and then medical power of attorney. I got mine through my State Farm insurance agent. He had these on hand and came over when the children were around together, and we signed them together, and we had it. So it's a very accessible form.
And there's another important advantage. Mm-hmm. If you people think about living wills and mm-hmm. what do I want, what I don't want. Those are hard to give good guidance. It leads, mm-hmm. how do we interpret them? You appoint somebody to speak for you. It's very simple. As Betty says, there's no complicated forms to do. And once you do it, there's no interpretive questions. All we have to do is say, ask the person, what should we do?
Probably, I would think, though, should ask that person beforehand if they're willing, that person is willing to serve in that capacity, presumably, because we've talked about how it empowers the advocates, mm-hmm. but it also creates a level of responsibility there. David?
Yes, you certainly want to speak to them, and you want to talk to them about what your wishes are so that their obligation is to act according to how you would want to be treated. And if you haven't had discussions with them, then it makes it much harder for them to carry out their responsibilities.
Now, is it effective? There are hospitals that are trying to create patient advocates for patients who do not have family or friends or people with power of attorney. Is that an effective means for doing some of these same things, Betty?
I'm asked that a lot also, John, and I guess if somebody doesn't have anybody else, that might be okay, but you have to remember these people are employed by the hospital. They're good people, and they're going to care for the patient, but how well will you see them? And they might just come into your room and say, hello, Mr. Kroll, how are you, and is everything okay, and here's my card, and you be sure to call me, and that's not really what I see the need for a patient advocate. You know, John, in my book, a patient advocate has to be there, as Dr. Orentlicker said, I suggest also they have a list of your medications. They know what your issues are because they may not even be able to be there 24/7. So maybe you need two or three people if it's a really serious crisis, because it has to be somebody. If somebody's coming in to give a pill, the wrong pill to the wrong person, wrong dosage, wrong bed, wrong time, all kinds of things. And somebody at the hospital simply cannot be there to do that. I've also been asked, where can I go to be a patient advocate? Are there organizations that provide this? This really is opening up a whole cottage industry. Mm-hmm. that is going to evolve, I think, into – there are a lot of women who are nurses, retired nurses, who want to go into this role. A lot of people who are retired who maybe have lost somebody who want to serve in this capacity. We are living longer. We've got a healthcare industry that's allowing us to live with more crises. I think – as we baby boomers begin to, like a tidal wave, sort of take over the population group, this issue is going to grow, and this may evolve into a larger industry than we're seeing now.
David, that idea of institutionalizing patient advocates, you know, putting somebody in that role as an internal critic, does it make sense or does it not?
Well, we know there are going to be people who don't have somebody to speak for them. Mm-hmm. And there are good programs, in fact, in our city out of the Methodist Hospital. Robin Bandy and colleagues have organized a very good program with the court so that if you need a court-appointed guardian, there's nobody, to family member, to turn to. There are people who are trained to serve this role, who do it on a regular basis, and they are, you know, guided their goal, and they do a very good job of trying to carry out what's in the patient's interest. Sometimes they have a sense of what the patient wants. Sometimes you don't have that information. Then you're guided by the patient's best interest. So yes, you do want to try to develop these programs, whether it's through the courts or internally. They're very important.
We are talking about patient rights and advocacy here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, I'd like to put this in a somewhat larger context. I mean, we're talking about the population. I know we've used the example of the two jumbo jets
mm-hmm.
crashing.
That's right.
Routinely, but if you're talking about more than 400,000 people, I mean, that annually, that's a good-sized city disappearing
yeah.
every year. And so there is a certain amount, obviously, of error built into any system. In this case, what are some steps that we could do to minimize the errors so that there are fewer stories like your husband's that occur? And beyond that, when they do occur, I mean, this was part of the debate over healthcare reform. I mean, it was, and you're still hearing that tort reform should be part of it, a cap on medical malpractice suits in this case. David, I'm going to let you start first with what should we do to prevent these kinds of things? Are there safeguards we could put in place, and then we'll talk about whether there ought to be ways to respond on the other end.
A very important question. And first, to start with, tort reform is not the answer. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, what we've seen is states have implemented lots of tort reforms, mm-hmm. caps on damage that are awarded, and so on. And not only don't they work, but in fact, they may be counterproductive. One of the things we've seen in recent studies is that in states that have adopted these damage caps, in other words, they've reduced the liability risk to physicians, is that physicians may be more likely to make mistakes. That there's a reason why we have these laws to deter bad conduct. But the more important thing, even if tort reform did work, was to prevent these harms. And what we need to... And there's been a lot of good efforts to identify what are the common mistakes, because the Institute of Medicine was right, as Betty said, to err is human. We know people are going to make mistakes. So what kind of safety, you know, what can you implement to make sure that when a mistake is made, it doesn't cause harm? And the anesthesiologists provide a great example that there's always been a risk that when you undergo surgery, you'll die from the anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
And found out one of the big mistakes was connecting the oxygen tube to the nitrogen tank or the anesthetic tank and giving you the wrong gas. And so what they could remind people, don't connect the wrong tube to the wrong tank. But what they decided to do was make it impossible to connect. So they have different size tubing for different tanks. And so you can never make that mistake again. And the risk of dying from anesthesia dropped by like 100-fold. And so that's what we need. That's the kind of thing we need to do, is instead of focusing on the individual, because people make mistakes, but to figure out how can we redesign the system to minimize the chances that mistakes will cause harm.
Mm-hmm. Out of your experience, Betty, what are some changes that...
Well, you know, I have a very, very active Facebook page. I have an opportunity to post, because I have so many people on it, to post. I look for studies and journalism reports all the time in the area of patient safety on this. And I look particularly at prevention. And David is right. I read somewhere that 80% of medical errors could be prevented. I know Indiana University, we should be proud, the School of Medicine has instituted a procedure following surgery where they are able to look for any pieces of anything, cotton or medical instruments, left inside the patient, which is a major cause of medical error leading to death. It's fairly expensive, but it gets minimized across the patient when you use it, and it cost maybe $250,000, but it's been a great safety valve. That was in a major study recently, and I'm proud to say that. There was another study that was done at Boston Children's Hospital. There have been reports that 80% of serious medical errors involve some form of miscommunication when you're passing patients from one provider to the other. This could be a change in shifts. And we've seen this particularly with the shifts of first-year residencies being reduced to about 14 hours instead of the long, long shifts. Now, you would think since they're less tired, they may make fewer mistakes, but you're passing patients off more. If that creates a higher incidence of error in going from one doctor to the other without adequate communication. So Boston Children's Hospital involved a study of about 1,200 people, and they just did a focus study on putting more time into communication between the providers in the passing off of patients, making sure they were speaking in a quiet space as opposed to a hurried rushing down the hallway. Here's the chart, blah, blah, I'm off now. And they found a 50% reduction in reported medical errors. These are not big things, but they're small things. I think our medical technology has gotten so sophisticated and so demanding on our providers' care, all of our medical personnel, that they spend so much time with the same technology that's supposed to help us. Sometimes it hinders. And what's happening in this particular study is that the medical personnel are now spending more time with patients, so that was another positive outcome. But they saw a 50% reduction of medical error just by instituting a guideline which requested that this communication between the providers in the change of shifts and shifting in from a patient's the what they call the pass off of quiet communication, a quiet space. That's so simple, John, when you think about it, but that amazing thing. So our hospital is willing to do it. We're so driven with cost factors because of what insurance companies are demanding and even what families are demanding, the technology is demanding, that the less patient care, the direct hands on patient care we're getting, that we're not getting, is really hindering the process.
We are talking about patient rights and advocacy here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Al, welcome to the program.
Hi, I've noticed that there's a number of hospital policies that make it difficult to advocate for a patient who doesn't want to give up their medical rights, but who, you know, you're there to support oftentimes when it has to do with a person in pain or following surgery or something like that, and you want to be supportive, but you're not in a place legally or otherwise to be able to say, no, this person's in pain, I need to have them seen, because the hospital just doesn't listen.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Betty.
I'm not quite sure what the person is asking, though. Can you help me a little bit, John?
Al, you want to reframe your question?
Well, I think there's hospital policy that keeps the hospitals from being able to listen to anyone who's involved with the patient, regardless of their best intentions. I've taken people into emergency rooms where the patients, and I knew what it was that they needed, but when they gave that information, the hospital, you know, tagged them as a drug seeker or said, no, you know, this is not high enough on the protocol.
Okay, thanks very
much. Well, yeah, I think I've heard the same thing, too, where people, in fact, that was one of the problems that led to the death of John James, Dr. John James, chief toxicologist for NASA, and led to his work. He's the one who wrote that report that appeared in Journal of Patient Safety, and he now consults with Consumers Report. And his son did have a medical issue, and he was a active athlete, and he landed in the hospital, and he was in the emergency room, and he knew what his son needed, and he didn't feel as though the people in the emergency room were listening, mm-hmm. and he died, and he knew what his son needed. This happens, and we can't gloss over it. Now, if he's asking if I have an answer, I have the same frustration, which is why I wrote the book, which is why my book is titled Stand in the Way. If you are that patient advocate and you feel you know something, you've got to really be assertive. You can't always save the person you're advocating for, though.
Well, and I guess where I go with it, I mean, obviously someone like Dr. James, a medical doctor with a training, probably would have a reasonable idea of what was wrong with his son. You know, I'm trained as a journalist. If I took one of my children to the emergency room, I wouldn't. So I make the other side of that argument that if you're in an emergency room, you know, admitting nurse or whatever, saying, well, yeah, I have no idea what this person's qualifications might be on the other side. David?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the issues that comes up is the fact that in the emergency room, they don't know you. They've never seen you mm-hmm. before. And something that may seem not unusual to them, the family member, I know this person. And when they complain of pain, it's got to mm-hmm. My kid is very stoic, and they never complain of pain. So if they're complaining of pain, this is a big problem. Or there's a case I remember an ethicist talking about where it was a university, and the mm-hmm. RA brought the student but didn't know the student well and didn't know that the student's way of talking was different than the normal way of talking. And that's something that the doctors, if they don't know the patient, just aren't going to have that kind of context. And it's very important for family members. Maybe they don't know what the diagnosis is, but they know something's wrong. I know my family member, and they wouldn't. This has got to be serious the way they're acting. And to try to make sure you deliver that kind of message is important.
Yeah, and I'm trying to get at here. I mean, at some level, if we're talking about emergency rooms and all of that, you've got people who are, everybody in that place is operating in a high-stress environment. The people who come in obviously are stressed out because they're not feeling well. They're dealing with an emergency. Presumably the people who bring them in also are feeling that because they're concerned about them. And, you know, the people who are working there also know that the stakes are pretty high. Are there protocols we can put in place to make sure that those kinds of questions get asked and answered, and that, you know, and maybe I'm asking an impossible question here, but is there any way we can take some of the stress out of it without removing some of the urgency, without removing any of the urgency?
No, that's exactly the right approach. You're right. These are stressful situations. People are going to make mistakes. If they have to think fast, they're going to forget things. And so if you have standardized protocols to make sure they ask all the right questions and do the right tests. And so if, you know, we don't have to worry about stress leading to somebody forgetting something. And that is an important development in medicine, that you do see people being told, if somebody comes in with chest pain, here are the steps you need to go through, and make sure you have that list and you check it off. And that's critical, absolutely, because you're right. Again, people are going to make mistakes, especially in stressful situations. So you want to have the system there to back up, just like to prevent people from amputating the wrong leg. There are all mm-hmm. these double checks people mm-hmm. have to do to make sure it's the right leg.
We are talking about patient rights and patient advocacy here on No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Betty Tonsing, who is the author of Stand in the Way, Patient Advocate Speak Out, former State Representative David Orrant Licker, who is both a medical doctor and a constitutional law professor. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about patient rights and patient advocacy here on No Limits. My guests are Betty Tonsing, who is the author of Stand in the Way, Patient Advocate Speak Out, and former State Representative David Orrant Licker, who is both a medical doctor and a constitutional law professor. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for hosting this nice dialogue. I wanted to call to respond to something David indicated in response to your question about caps, limits, and tort reform. He mentioned that there are studies showing that states that have those tend to have higher malpractice occurrences, and I don't buy that, number one. And number two, Indiana is a state that has those limits and caps dating back to Governor Doc Bowen. And what is it that he's referring to or relying upon, number one? And number two, is that just an issue, if it is true, of correlation, or is he suggesting causation, as if the limits would cause more malpractice? I'd be interested in hearing a response to that.
Great. Thanks very much for the call and the questions.
Very good question. Yeah, there's a group of researchers that are at Northwestern University, University of Chicago, University of Texas, and University of Illinois who have been doing a lot of studies on the impact of tort reforms. And if you want to see their studies, they're on the Social Science Research Network, SSRN.com. Bernie Black and Charlie Silver and David Hyman are some of the researchers. They do very good work, and some of their results are surprising. But what they've looked at is tried to compare as carefully as they can, because these are not randomized studies, you're absolutely right, but comparing what happens when you compare states that have damage caps with states that don't have damage caps and trying to control for all the other variables. They do not find any benefit in terms of what we would hope to get from tort reform, and that the evidence does seem to suggest that you get higher, that you lose the deterrence effect of tort reform, that people are more likely to make mistakes, that we don't know exactly why. One of their speculations is that when you reduce the risk of liability for doctors, they won't have to worry about being sued or to pay as much. They may be more willing to do riskier procedures than they would otherwise, and that may be why you're seeing more malpractice. But they're pretty careful studies, and they're the best data we have.
We've also gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Michael. It says, thanks for this show. As a healthcare professional and former hospice worker, I have seen too many people struggle with these issues while they are dealing with their own or a loved one's serious illness, and it would have served them well to have prepared ahead of time. It is much more challenging to make these decisions while also under stress and emotional influence. Does Dr. Tonsing know of any programs to train as a patient advocate?
You know, John, not specifically. I think this is still new, and I think this is still – there may be various universities, I think, that are looking at this because, as I said earlier, this is a growing industry. I think there are people who are going into – the administrative side to go in and provide better care at nursing homes, because we can't forget nursing homes too. They're very culpable in all of this. We're talking about emergency rooms and hospitals, but a lot of these issues also take place in nursing homes. But I don't know of any particular curriculum yet set. maybe Dr. Ortlinger knows of this. I think this will eventually happen, though, because there's a demand and people willing to go into it. And you have current healthcare providers like nurses who are doing it, who are finding organizations who are providing it. But there's not a specific that I know of. And I'd like to know if there is so I can pass that information on.
Yeah, I'm not aware either. As I mentioned, there is the program to train mm-hmm. court-appointed advocates out of the Fairbanks Ethics Center at Methodist. So they might know about whether there are other kinds of patient advocate programs.
We are talking about patient rights and patient advocacy here on No Limits. Marion, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. As I was listening, I'm a retired nurse who assists the dying as a terminal midwife, and I often advocate and liaison between hospitals, especially locally in rural Indiana, between the ICU and the terminally ill that just want to go home to die. Seems like only the rich can really get, you know, they need advocacy to get out. But I find it so tragic over the years. I mean, I'm 68 years old, but I find it so disconcerting over the years that people like me or what I did for my parents, or that now we're putting this on the patients. We're putting this on the family of the patients. I mean, I had to go in and guard my mother because there wasn't enough staff to watch her, and she was one of the worst, you know, Alzheimer's you could imagine. But there wasn't staff to let me go home and get a night's sleep, you know, because of the insurance companies, because of everything, it's a system based on fear, and it's a system that's not working. And why do we have to go advocate for our parents? That's not healing. We should be able to, you know, we try to work with people, but I was there protecting my parents and my friends from a system that is based on money and fear and record keeping. And it's a culture of our healthcare industry, and now we're making an industry out of advocating. So, you know, it's scary to me.
Yeah, let me let David and Betty respond. You've made some excellent points here, Marion. Probably given us a whole nother show, but let me do that. Thank you very much for the call. I really do appreciate it.
Okay, I'll listen. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. David, I'll let you start, then Betty.
No, her main point, this should not be the responsibility of the family members. We should not put the burden on them to make sure that we give good care to patients in this country. And the responsibility has to be on healthcare providers to change the way they provide care. This patient advocacy is a fallback, and you need to do it because we're not there yet. We don't have the optimal system, but no, that shouldn't be where the primary focus is. That's a very important point. The other point about we still don't do a great job of caring for the dying. We do a better job than mm-hmm. we did when I remember when I was in practice and working at a VA hospital, and they opened their first hospice unit, and how reluctant doctors were to admit patients to hospice. There was the sense that you were giving up if you turned to hospice, and were much better about using palliative care and hospice care and meeting the needs of the dying as they see mm-hmm. them. But we do have a long way to go. There's no question about it.
Betty.
Yeah, I totally agree with what David has just said. You know, we're also talking about nursing homes, too. And I think the caller was really referring to this other area we can't mm-hmm. ignore. You know, we're in the hospital for just a short period of time, and that's where the major impact of medical error and hospital infections. But a lot of the people I interviewed and the people who responded, the hundreds of people in the questionnaire, were also dealing with a nursing home situation. And I think that's what the caller, and there's so much despair and stress going on there. And she's absolutely right. The largest growing number of nursing homes are for-profit corporate chains. There's a great deal of concern as to what the bottom line is. Is it patient care or is it the dollar? There is great concern about the ratio of patients to staff, the adequacy of care, the level of training. I mean, I have a lot of stories about that, and there is a lot of concern. We are living longer. We have technology that allows us to do that. We're not. We have homes now where both parents are working. It has become very complex. I'll be honest with you. When I was going through the situation with my husband, and I tried desperately to bring him home to see if I couldn't take care of him, and he became really incognitant mentally as well as physically. He never left the wheelchair because of his infection, and he died 11 months later of other complications. But the few times I brought him home, I desperately needed help. My kids could be home for a couple of nights, but I turned to a large major church that I was involved with to see if they didn't have a ministry so that at night someone could just come and be with him. He didn't require nursing care. He was nocturnal because of his dementia that he had that manifested out of all of this. And I couldn't find any. There was no ministry. I thought that would be a great ministry for churches to sort of become in, not to let the medical industry off the hook, but what families, many families are just looking for is just, I need help. So I can get some help. I need someone maybe to come, for example, and spend the night. So when I had my husband home on the weekends, I could sleep. That maybe someone who's has someone at home, you can get out and take a walk, go to the park, go to the grocery store, do the things that you need to do. That might be a wonderful ministry. This is going to become, John, as we live older, and this is going to become, and I know she doesn't like the word industry, but it's going to be a major factor. We're going to live longer with more illnesses and need for more care.
I think Marion's onto something, because as we've been talking, I've been flashing back to a conversation I think we had on this show when we were talking about how doctors are trained. And one of the doctors said, you know, when I went to medical school, I did it because I wanted to help people. Yes, I wanted to make a good living, but I wasn't aware of sort of all of the business aspects going in, the fact that I was going to have to worry about billing and all of these other things. And it strikes me in this conversation, we're sort of walking that fault line here. I mean, we tend to think of medicine. I mean, we don't refer to, you know, a doctor and the people he works with as his consumers or his market or anything, or her market. You know, this whole idea, their patients, whether, because in some ways what we're talking about here, it sounds like, is consumer advocacy as well, becoming a consumer of medical services. But the whole medical practice itself is set up in some ways on principles that don't work with that. David, you're nodding your head here.
You know, I think that's so, it's so unfortunate that there are other interests that are driving it, that the interests of the drug companies, the hospitals, the physicians. And I remember when I was in my practice days, we used to say hospitals are designed for doctors, not for patients. Mm-hmm. Now that's changing. If you walk into they look like hotels now. So things are moving more in the patient-oriented direction. But it is a problem. Or when you just think about the Affordable Care Act, that we're spending $1 trillion and only a few percent are going to public health measures that really have a much bigger impact on people's health. And yes, the dollar explains a lot. The drive for the dollar explains a lot with our system, and it's not right. That's absolutely correct.
I want to try to get at least one more, maybe a couple more callers in. Nicole, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Certainly.
So my first comment/question is, in practicing law in the state of Indiana, I have found that medical malpractice claims with the cap and whatnot have kind of gone down, not necessarily because the doctors aren't committing the acts of medical malpractice, but just because patients try to frame their claims in such a way that they don't fall under medical malpractice. So they try to have it act as like a different tort. So I was interested to hear the studies show that medical malpractice claims go up in the states with the cap, just because that's kind of contrary to what I found, that people try to avoid anything that has to do with the Medical Malpractice Act just to avoid that cap. So that's my first comment/question, if you think that that's valid or if that's just something I'm observing from inside my little foxhole. And then on what you guys were saying as far as consumers and doctors and patients, I've worked with the military for a long time, and we have to send a lot of our soldiers in the state of Indiana, because we don't have an active base, to civilian doctors to get their treatment done. And it is just such a hassle to get any type of bottom dollar. This is how much this treatment is going to cost from this, for this soldier, from any hospital or doctor's office. I mean, you have to call, get transferred and transferred again, and then wait for them to call you back before you can get anybody. And even then, they'll give you a quote of, this is how much this could cost, but we don't really know until we perform the procedure that this is how much it actually will cost. So I was wondering if you have any thoughts on them making it a little bit more consumer-friendly as far as finding out, like kind of doing price shopping, I guess, with hospitals.
Thanks very much for the call and the questions, Nicole. Betty, I'm going to give you first crack.
Oh, I don't think I'm – that's not an area, John. I'm going to
defer to
defer
David.
To David, yeah, yes. Okay, I think he David. Carries the expertise in
yeah,
this.
Yeah, on Nicole's first question, no, you're absolutely right. Damage caps do lead to fewer claims. The other study that shows that you get more malpractice – so I'll have to go back and look, but my guess is that they're measuring not by looking just at claims, but other measures of the number of errors. Because you're right, in general, if your recoveries are limited, fewer people are going to sue. So they're measuring how much malpractice is going on in different ways. Because you're right, claims go down, but malpractice is going up. The other question about price transparency, this is a big problem. There's no question about it, that it is very frustrating. We want people to shop around and compare prices, but it's very hard to do that. Unlike what happens if you're paying out of pocket and you go to a cosmetic surgeon, they'll tell you what their price is, and they have no trouble figuring it out. So it's possible to do it, and our system of insurance makes it has allowed hospitals to hide, but fortunately insurers are pushing hospitals to provide more price information, because we do want people to shop around, and if one hospital costs $50,000, it's no better than a hospital that costs $25,000. Insurers do want the person to choose the less expensive hospital, so there are efforts to move in that direction.
I've gotten an email question from a listener who just wants to go by the initial E. I am guessing there is no insurance reimbursement for paid patient advocates, correct? If reimbursement was available for this, I'd bet hospitals would start providing advocates. Mm. Betty?
Yep, that's I'm David's shaking his head. Yes, I think we're both in agreement with that. Remember again, John, this is something new, and that patient advocates have typically in the past been a family member, and they've not been taken very seriously. I think that hospitals that have that you can get off the elevator of any floor practically, and right there are the pictures of the advocates that represent the hospital, but they represent the hospital. They maybe also be ombudsmen, very, very good people, but it's not the role that we're really talking about today. And no, there's no reimbursement for that.
And I'm afraid that will have to be the last word. I would like to thank my guest, former State Representative David Orentlicker, and Betty Tonsing, who is the author of Stand in the Way, Patient Advocates Speak Out. It was a pleasure talking with both of you.
Thank you, John.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And I also would like to thank all of our listeners and apologize to those we were not able to get your questions answered. This is not going to be the last time we talk about this subject, so we will get your questions answered next time. Please join us on Thursday when we're going to be talking about talking with educational expert Paul Tough. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.